So I'm going to talk about stickiness, just as Jay set up, and I also wanted to plug the walk afterwards on the Rose Kennedy Greenway. That's actually a shot from it. It's a really active and lovely environment, and it's a great example of a massive infrastructure project that I think changed the very heart and soul of that portion of the city, which you'll really experience if you walk there now. So I implore you to join that. I'm going to sort of take Ayman, who I consider one of my great mentors and sort of the brains behind this entire movement, and sort of say, so what does that imply for actual, sort of the next level now, intervention. A lot of you, I hope you see yourselves as interventionists, and I'll just make a few simple points. I'd like to remind you, and I know you know this, if you do this work, simply telling people to exercise has not solved this problem remotely. It's not sticky to just encourage and educate. That, in fact, historically in public health, we've taken an environmental approach, so it's not unusual for Jay to say what he did about environmental approaches, and that indeed I'd submit to you that the research literature, not just from public health, but from fields like planning and transportation engineering, describe for us four things that characterize environments where people tend to be more physically active, particularly through routine walking, bicycling, and transit activity. And then I'll suggest that we have to be the conveners and leave you with a couple of thoughts about what I see happening around the country suggesting success, or at least pathways for success. That's a shot from Somerville. I'm so proud of the work. I'm glad you're going to hear about Somerville later. And I just want to point out that those people don't have to be walking into that fitness club to be getting exercise. If they get 15 minutes of walking along the wonderful sidewalks of Somerville, and are able to cross streets safely as a result of that, and they get 30 minutes of physical activity informally during the day, it still counts. Ayman taught me that years ago. It doesn't have to be structured, sort of change your clothes, go to a gym exercise. We have to remind ourselves of that. We also have to remind ourselves that if you see intervention studies like this one, which is a plot of exercise minutes per week over an 18-month period, but of which only the first 6 months was the actual exercise intervention, this is work by John Jakisic at University of Pittsburgh's Medical Center, you'll notice that although exercise minutes per week increased over the 6 months of the intervention, they also dropped off afterwards. There are not lots of these studies. Most of the studies end here and declare victory. We say, oh, we increased exercise minutes. It's rare to go back and look at the cohort after we've stopped calling them on the phone and sending them email reminders and giving them T-shirts and water bottles, because that's what we do in health promotion. We give out T-shirts and water bottles. Everybody's laughing nervously because you all know, yeah, that's me. It's me, by the way. But, you know, when you do see studies that look at cohorts after the intervention period, again, 6 months, this done at the Cooper Clinic in Dallas, Texas, you see this drop-off. Okay, this is not uncommon. It's the lack of stickiness that I'm talking about. You don't get that sustained effect if all we do is sort of educate and encourage, focus on the individual behavior change. By the way, the weight loss literature is full of these kinds of studies, early weight loss followed by regain. And I'm not saying, I agree fully with Ayman that physical activity, independent risk factor, we should measure that, but as a marker, obesity has shown very, very difficult to change at the population level through just behavior change programs. This, by the way, compared Weight Watchers, the yellow line, to being in a self-help program, and although people initially lost more in Weight Watchers, you see the stickiness problem prevails, right? They're regaining the weight. Now, I hope everybody in the room is familiar and has seen many, many graphical illustrations of what the answer to that is. We assert the answer is to take a socio-ecological approach, to not just focus on the individual, but all the other risk factors, the other influences that alter behavior. So at the not just individual, but interpersonal level, at the institutional level, your workplace, your healthcare provider, the city or town, your community by its design, and even public policy. And we have lots of examples in public health that we hold up, most notably, of course, tobacco, but others that are illustrations of having not just focused on the individual, but taking all the way up to a public policy level approach to changing a healthy or an unhealthy behavior, whether it's cigarette use, where we don't just say don't smoke, it's bad for you, but we make it hard to smoke in public places. We've taxed the daylights out of the product. It's not advertised on television anymore. My kids will never get on an airplane and be submitted to secondhand smoke. Not because we ask people, hey, there are kids on the plane, it'd be nice if you don't smoke. That's not how it works, right? It's illegal. The flight attendant can tell the pilot to land the plane and state troopers can drag you off, right? We've changed the rules. And I think that that's what we have to think about around physical activity. What's the analogy? Because that's not that easy. Indeed, I'm going to suggest to you that if you go back to the kind of the classic social ecology model, the easy stuff to think of is the 20-week walking program at a workplace, or the Know Your Number campaigns where we do education and encouragement and give out, again, T-shirts and water bottles. But the stuff that has population-level impact is at the base of the pyramid. When we change physical infrastructure. Again, I'll ask groups when I'm doing a community workshop, what would be easier, 16-week walking program or change your zoning ordinance to make sure every subdivision is built with sidewalks and bicycle lanes? It's an easy answer, right? Well, I know how to do the 16-week walking program. I don't have a clue about how to change the zoning ordinance. Hey, I'm in public health. That's not even my job, right? Well, indeed, Somerville's going to tell us part of the answer in a moment. But you should first ask, do we even have evidence that changing the environment would matter? If we build it, will they come? I'm going to suggest to you, and this is a gross oversimplification of a pretty big body of literature, but I'm going to boil it down to four things. I think these four things characterize environments where people are more routinely active as a part of daily life. I think a greater variety of different kinds of destinations close together, good connecting facilities for the opportunity to walk, bike, take transit between them. When you get to the destination, it's rewarding rather than punishing you for showing up without your car. And last but not least, it's got to be safe and accessible for everybody in the community, all ages, all incomes, all abilities and disabilities, right? It's got to work for everybody. So photos from my work all over the country, but intermingled some shots from Somerville. I'm sure you'll recognize Mayor Curtatone. But mix of land use, what we really mean, our planning colleagues would tell what this is a mix of land uses. But what we're really saying is let's have where we live and work and shop and play and learn and pray. The more those things are mixed together, think traditional main street in a small town, think the urban core of a big city. Where the more you have that variety, the more likely people are to walk or bike or take transit between those things, right? And indeed, there are studies. So this is an example. We can show you many, but I'm just to give you a flavor. This was a nice study done by Wendy King with Andrea Kriska at Pittsburgh. And what they looked at was, did elderly women walk more in environments where there were more destinations nearby? And even when they controlled for other stuff like age and income level and education and health status, they found when they objectively measured, not self-report data, but put accelerometers on their hips, the women who lived in neighborhoods with more rich environmental mix, right, were more likely to take almost twice as many steps measured by a pedometer. So that's an example of the kind of research. I'm not going to go on and on about the research. I'm going to beg your indulgence and that you trust sort of that body of literature is out there. And I'll show you a resource later if you want to find more. Second, though, we have to connect those facilities, right? You got to have the sidewalks, the bike lanes, the trails, the transit system that connects those facilities together. You have to maintain them. That's why the winter shot, if you're in a cold weather environment. Are those sidewalks plowed? Is that wonderful multi-use trail cleared? As it is in Rapid City, South Dakota, where they told me that they clear the trail that goes right through the heart of their downtown because so many kids use it to walk to school that if they didn't clear it in the winter, those kids would be getting driven by parents, thus cluttering the streets around the schools with cars, thereby making it harder to plow the streets. So they've actually taken that as a tactical policy level approach to make their snow clearing easier, make sure we keep the trails clear so the kids can walk to school along those trails. Why do I mention transit? Because there are a growing body of studies that tell us regular transit riders are more likely statistically to get that or a portion of that 30 minutes per day. And notably, that seems to be preferentially beneficial to lower income residents. Not shocking. They may be more likely to be using transit and dependent on it. But the act of walking to and from the bus stop, the subway, and keep this in mind, by the way. Many people will say, I live in a small town, Mark. We don't have a transit system. We don't have fixed route transit. I'm out in rural Massachusetts, rural Iowa, where we've done more. And I'll say, do you have yellow school buses? That's a form of mass transit. Do you have a dial-a-ride or a senior shuttle? That's a form of transit. Keep in mind that transit refers to that body of sort of mass transit vehicles. Third, when I get to my destination, does it tell me show up by car or does it reward me for showing up on foot? The picture in the lower left, sort of a classic downtown or a main street, wide sidewalks, benches, awnings, street trees. Those things are not just aesthetic amenities. We used to refer to them in the planning field as the amenities, the aesthetics, but I'm seeing the mayor nod because he knows sort of the difference for my 74-year-old mom, whether she's going to walk from the seniors' housing that she lives in to the nearby pharmacy or the nearby park, it may be the presence of a bench under a shade tree along the way. Lacking that, she asks for a ride, right? So those are not just amenities if we think of my criteria that is, it has to serve all members of the society. And last but not least, safety and access. Here's where I will defend my discipline. I'm an engineer by training, and many times we blame the engineers. Well, they made roads wider and straighter so that we could move more cars faster. Well, that's what we asked for the last 50 years. We complained when we had to sit through two light cycles to make a left turn, right, at rush hour. So they gave us double left turn lanes, which are horrible for pedestrians, because even if the first driver yields for you, the second one may not, and you get what's called a multiple threat collision. So my point is there's an entire science around this. The engineers know how to make places where pedestrians, bicyclists, transit, and motor vehicles can coexist, but you have to ask for it. Our walk along the Greenway, if you join us, will show lots of these kinds of things, crossing islands and curb extensions where the curb is bumped out, how they work to the benefit of pedestrians. So, If you're saying, wow, you went really fast, where can I learn more about this? That website at the bottom, maintained by Jim Salas and his team out of University of California, San Diego, activelivingresearch.org, is a good starting place for this literature. Wouldn't you say, Jay, if you were going to sort of dip your toe and start to learn about it, it's a great place to start to see where's the evidence argument for this? Which is all great, but then you should ask me, okay, I got this picture, how do we actually get there? What are communities doing to change? And I'm going to tell you, the first thing I'm seeing that characterizes successful communities around the country is they're building a leadership team, what I call the stealth team, that is interdisciplinary. It's not just all the usual suspects, public health, the hospital, the YMCA, you know, the park and rec department, all the people that think about fitness and exercise. But they've got public works, planning, the transit authority, housing officials. They're all in the mix. Elected officials, as you hear from the Somerville story. And I say start with a small team. Many places say, we're going to build a big coalition, 50 people. You bring 50 people to the room. Jay and I have been in those meetings in Hawaii. We can get nothing done. You give me the 10 movers and shakers, we can build a strategic plan, and then we can start to pick away at this stuff. So, three criteria to be on my stealth team, if you're curious. One, you have to be somebody who embraces this vision of environmental design. Don't walk in the door and say, we're going to buy 1,000 pedometers and give out t-shirts and water bottles. I'm not interested. Not right now. Later we can do that. We've got to build the sticky environment first. Two, it's got to be part of your job to work on this. So if I'm going to be striping bike lanes, I need the people from my public works department in the conversation, which indeed they've done in Somerville. And three, these are the people of reach and influence, so when you do need that much bigger coalition, they're one phone call or email away. And when you do need to mobilize the hundreds or the, you know, for the big coalition meeting, they can get them there. Having said that, you might say, well, what should they be working on? This was an invited review paper I did for the journal Childhood Obesity, which I wish was called Childhood Physical Activity and Nutrition, but because, again, to your point, I mean, we always focus on obesity. Having said that, these, I think, are the five big levers we're seeing communities pull on. And you can go grab that paper. I think you can get it online, still available, but land use and planning, zoning ordinances, complete streets, transportation trails. In other words, this is wonkish kind of sort of stuff from the policy world. But, you know, what does that mean for a local public health agent? There are very practical things you could do. You could show up at a planning or a school board meeting and be the one who speaks up against closing the downtown elementary school and building another new school out on the edge of town that every kid will have to be driven to for the lifetime of the school. You could be part of that conversation. And indeed, we're seeing public health agents convene stealth teams, like I just talked about, and change the conversation about these sorts of decisions. Or you could be the one that reaches out to economic development and says, why are we going to let them build that Barnes & Noble out on the edge, on that strip mall, out on the edge of Terre Haute? Why shouldn't it be right downtown near Indiana State University and be the bookstore, and let's put some apartments above it. Let's make it a two-story building, make it really mixed use. So those are real-world examples from around, you know, the country. You could get on your community's bicycle pedestrian advisory committee. You could reach out to the Department of Public Works and say, why don't we embrace complete streets? That's a national campaign. In fact, just curious, who here knows the term complete streets? Okay, good. That's a step forward for us in public health. 5 years ago, I asked that question, two hands go up. Seriously, no exaggeration, right, Jay? So, complete streets, simple premise. A street's not complete unless it takes into account all four users, the pedestrian, the bicyclist, transit, motor vehicles. That street in Somerville was made more complete largely by the application of paint and improved crosswalks, striped bike lanes, and a pedestrian sign in the middle. It's not a gazillion dollars. Now, some of the projects you guys have done are expensive, but that's fairly short money. It was more about political will and the technical skill in the public works department and a little push from public health to get it there. What about trails? Everybody loves these great 20-mile trails out on the edge of town. I like them too. They're not the most important. Give me a trail that connects from a neighborhood to a school, from senior housing to shopping, that's a quarter mile long, but let somebody walk on it every day as opposed to drive their car to a trailhead. Indeed, there are studies that tell us the more used sections of trails are connected to other elements of the network, think sidewalks, bike lanes, transit stops, and connect to destinations, think schools, playgrounds, parks, shopping, housing. Right? That's what the research tells us. And we need to equip ourselves, collectively, the public health movement, to stand in defense of these ideas when the NIMBYs show up. Everybody know what a NIMBY is? You have the big public meeting, and they're the person that says, not in my backyard. That trail, weird men with big, thick mustaches are going to come down that trail. They'll be peering in our windows. We don't want a trail back there. We got to tell them, hey, you know what the evidence tells us? Your housing value is going to be higher. You're going to be on that trail. You're going to actually, when you go to sell your home, list that in the real estate listing. three bedroom, two bath on the trail. And we see that all the time. How about a bicycle-friendly community? I have colleagues here from the Alliance for Bicycling and Walking. Wave your hands, Jeff. And from the League of American Bicyclists that work on these sorts of activities. So say hi to them. It's the guy who has the opposite amount of hair to me. See all my hair? That's Jeff right there. Wave again, Jeff Miller. Not so much hair. We're the opposite. So Jeff, they're doing great work, advocacy work, teaching people. And for example, your community can earn a rating from bronze to platinum for being bike friendly. A business or a campus can do the same thing. And I got to tell you, elected officials love these kinds of recognitions. They like to be a tree city. We like to be a bike-friendly city. So there are programs like this, from bike education programs to the bike share. Take advantage. That's from Charlotte, North Carolina. Take advantage of Boston's bike share. It's going to be 60 degrees tomorrow. Go to one of the stations. Rent a bike for $4 for the day, I think, or five. I can't remember what the one-day rental fee is. And go ride a bike on the Rose Kennedy Greenway tomorrow. Last but not least, Safe Routes to School shows great promise. The same idea here. Let's talk about systems change. That's not just through encouraging kids to walk and bike to school, but like this school in Columbia, Missouri that was overrun with traffic out in front. They actually created a remote drop-off area at the other end of a park adjoining the school, beautiful trail through the park, and then they said, if you pick up or drop off your kid over there in the park and let him walk through the park, you can go pick him up right with school releases. But the cars that pull in front of the school, we're going to freeze those for 5 minutes. Those cars don't move while all the bicyclists and pedestrians leave. So we avoid conflicts between pedestrians trying to cross the street while the frantic parent is trying to pull out of the pickup line, right? And so they systematically created advantage for the pedestrians and bicyclists and those taking the school buses, which were also picking up on the other side of the park. And the kids were starting to tell their parents, don't pick me up in front of the school. Please, let me walk across the park. I get to leave at the normal time. I don't have to sit in the gym for an hour. It was 5 minutes, by the way. But to a kid, that's infinity at the end of the day. So they said, let me go. This guy's walking across a bridge in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania that used to be a car bridge, turned into a bicycle pedestrian facility. I said, where are you going? He says, out to the island. There's an island in the Susquehanna River that has a giant baseball diamond. Their minor league team is out there. And he says, I park out there. It's $1 a day. Why don't you park downtown by the city capitol where you work? $7 a day, $8 a day. I said, do you get a lot of exercise because of this? No. How often do you do that? Oh, every day. I work down there. So he didn't think it was exercise, but he's getting 30 minutes of physical activity every day to save $7 on parking. It's an infrastructure effort, right? We built a walkable bridge and a policy decision, cheap parking on the island, expensive downtown, and we get the behavior out of him. I don't care if he thinks it's exercise, nor necessarily does he have to lose weight to be beneficial. If he gets the 30 minutes a day, right, Iman, we know he benefits from a risk standpoint, even if his weight does not change dramatically. So that's the good news. We know how to do it. The bad news is we are not doing it on scale. We are winning battles. Nice bridge here, great bike lane there, nice, you know, sidewalk here. But we are building tons of this all over the United States. We are still permitting subdivisions without sidewalks and strip malls without any bicycle parking. And the buildings are set back behind acres of parking. And here's my point. You need to be the agents of change in your community, I would argue, as the story we're going to hear from Somerville illustrates. And you need to make systematic change so that everything we do, not just the occasional battle, the sidewalk here, the bike trail there, everything we do systematically takes into account design for physical activity. That's just got to be how we do business going forward. And we need to be the conveners. We need to pull together those stealth teams and make that a reality in our communities. Last point, if you or colleagues in some of those allied disciplines, planning, public works, in fact, ideally you would bring an interdisciplinary team, would like some experiential training. There is a National Smart Growth Conference that happens in Denver this February. I've got cards about this, so there's a field training, basically. We're going to do community workshops. We're going to go out and show you how to do this and presumably bring those skills back to your own community. So I'll leave these cards in the back if something like that interests you or perhaps your colleagues in allied disciplines, again, planning, public works, economic development, if you think they might be interested in it. So thank you very much, and I'll look forward to chatting with you some more about it.